Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome. We had a week off. Well, you had a week off. I had conferences. We will have, if you remember, we will meet next week. Then the week after that is the Wednesday that we always take off before Thanksgiving. So we won't meet that Wednesday, and then we will resume on that Wednesday after Thanksgiving. Okay, so one more class, Thanksgiving break, and then we're coming to the end of what I call the fall semester, so that we can take our Christmas break and begin the winter semester. We don't have a spring semester; we have a fall and winter semester. What you have before you is a kind of an outline of what we're going to be talking about. This is a commentary on this section of Isaiah by a Cistercian writer, Aelred of Rivaulx, who was a student of St. Bernard of Clairvaux. And in fact, early on, you will get people who think that what I'm about to tell you is actually St. Bernard of Clairvaux. There's a kind of confusion about authorship initially. But later on that got clarified, and it's this fellow who was a student of Bernard of Clairvaux. So you're getting a little Cistercian spirituality this morning. I don't know how often you get Cistercian spirituality, but today is the day. And what he does is takes these various prophecies that Isaiah makes, and he takes into account their context, but he now applies it to the moral and spiritual life. Okay, so I thought that might be helpful for us this morning, is to take these various things that are prophecies against Babylon or against the Philistines, against the Egyptians. What are we morally and spiritually supposed to get out of these prophecies? Please remember that what very often is translated as prophecy or oracle, I've kept the term that's used in the Vulgate translation, burden, onus. You know, when we talk about the onus is on you for doing this, right? The burden, the responsibility is on you. And the idea of translating it as burden or weight is that when you do wrong, when you sin against God's law, there are burdens that are on you. There's burdens of in terms of punishment. There are burdens on you in terms of reparation about what you are expected to do or how you are expected to change. But it's like the way that we talk about responsibility creating sort of a weight or a burden, right? Again, like we talk about how the onus is on you, the responsibility is on you. So you have done wrong, you've created a debt in a way through sin, and there has to be a way in which you change, in which you restore the balance. And so Aelred will look through these various burdens and apply them to the moral and spiritual life. Let's start with Babylon, which we've been talking about already. In verse 11, chapter 13, verse 11, I will punish the world's guilt. I will tax the wicked with their misdoings, stilling the rebels' pride, crushing the haughtiness of tyrants. Remember that Babylon is, at this point, is famous for its wealth and its power under Nebuchadnezzar and his successors. They are able to sort of muscle their way around, you know, the Mideast. And so Aelred uses that as significant of the moral and spiritual life insofar as the way in which the love of the world is a part of our souls, is a part of our makeup. In the way that Babylon is being denounced, here's the burden against you. That's the thing internally we have to ask, to what extent do I need to change in terms of my love of the world? And notice I put in your note that I put to you, particularly greed, particularly our love of material things. A lot of times, of course, however, greed for us overlaps vanity. I think it's C.S. Lewis who says somewhere, if you were to deck out a woman in diamonds on the condition that she never left the house, would these diamonds really be of value to her? So often, what it is we enjoy with our wealth is not just the comforts that it brings, but also being able to show it off, being able to have a new car and a new kind of car. So insofar as we have the cupidity right? That kind of excessive desire for the things of the world, that creates a kind of burden on us. Cornelius Elapide, in discussing this passage, talks about how it is that, in fact, there's a threefold burden. Labore, timore, dolore. In other words, the work that's involved in achieving the wealth, the fear that's involved in losing it, and then the sorrow that's involved when, in fact, you do lose it or lose portions of it. You know, there's an emotional cost to poverty, but there's also an emotional cost to wealth. It never comes without worry. It's never maintained without worry. Aelred concludes this reflection by talking about how, you know, if you seek the delights that are provided by the world, you must let them go, or you will suffer as the world suffers. Okay. Now, the idea, of course, in letting it go doesn't mean that you just give everything to charity. The issue always is, how attached are you to it? You could have somebody who's lower income who's more attached to what they have than someone who's upper income. But, of course, the challenge, that's why Jesus says how hard it is for the rich to enter heaven, quite frankly, one of the occupational hazards of enjoying wealth is, in fact, that you're attached to it. That's one of the, just like the occupational hazard of being a chef, you know, is that you eat too much and that you eat too fine. The occupational hazard of being an actor is you always want people to pay attention to you all the time. There are every state in life, every career, every occupation has its own occupational hazard. And that's the occupational hazard, of course, of wealth. We talked about chapter 14 last time. We focus most of our attention on verses 12 down to 16 or so, where we talked about how it is that the exaltation of the Babylonian king is like the rebellion of the devil, that it becomes a kind of image of that. As you keep reading, you'll notice at the end of chapter 14, there is a burden against the Philistines. This starts in verse 29. Rejoice not, O Philistia, all of you, that the rod which struck you is broken, for from the serpent's root shall come forth an adder, and its fruit shall be a flying serpent. By the way, in some translations, basilisk. Flying serpent's okay, but don't you want a basilisk, if you could like get a basilisk? In any event, the context, the historical or literal context, if you like, is that right now these neighbors of the Israelites who are perpetually causing them trouble, you recall the Philistines way back from the book of Judges, that other countries, other nations are putting down Judea, or putting down the Israelites, they rejoice in that, right? They rejoice in the fact that they're getting crushed. And Isaiah is clearly saying to them, you know, you're going to get it too. don't think that that what's happening to the Israelites is only going to happen to them, and you're going to just be able to rejoice. Remember, that's one of the ongoing concerns here, and it's the ongoing concern on the historical level through these various prophecies. The Israelites eventually will get or learn or understand that they deserve to suffer for their rebellion against God. But the galling part is that all these pagans around them seem to be benefiting at their expense. Hey, if the issue is that we're rebelling against God, well, these guys are unbelievers. Why aren't they suffering? And the consolation of Isaiah is they will. But you're suffering first because you're more responsible. You know more. You shouldn't be... The pagans could have the, you know, if you like, the excuse of not knowing as much as you do, of not being spoken to by the Lord in the same way. What is your excuse? What is your excuse? That is one of the, you know, that is one of the costs of knowing more, that you become more responsible. When I was at Boston College, I remember at one point telling students, by the way, students who had probably been at Catholic schools most of their lives, that you're required to go to Mass every Sunday. And for many of them, that was news. They didn't go to Catholic schools where they told them things like that. And I said, and now that I've told you, you're responsible. And I had kids who were, they would cover their ears. No, I'm not listening. No, no, no. They don't want to hear. But that's, you know, that that's negligence. You are deliberately avoiding what you know you could know and should know. When I think of that episode, I think of a friend of mine who was an evangelical Christian, and he came into the church, came into the Catholic Church, and he said, you know, my experience is, and he's an evangelical Christian, you know, when you think about all the things that are out there, fathers, doctors, and whatnot, and, you know, it's like we had 10% of the truth, but as evangelical Christians, we used 100% of our 10%. And I just feel like coming into the Catholic Church, you guys have 100% of the truth, and it's like you use 10% of it. You know, you don't use what you've got. There's a lot to be said for that. What is it that? How is it that now Aelred looks at the Philistines? They are looked at in terms of pride, because think of that celebration, celebrating over their enemies, celebrating it. You're getting it, and we're safe. And the language then of Aelred is that. That you don't want to fall through what he calls the inebriation of pride. You don't want to fall that you become intoxicated. Don't we talk that way? Intoxicated by success. That to become intoxicated by pride, that you will in turn suffer what it is the people who are intoxicated with pride. You will be drinking the same drink, is how he puts it. So that whatever our successes are, that we don't sort of revel in those successes, or that those successes, again, don't go to our head. That's the way that he puts it. Very helpful. Moab. Gosh, it's always so disturbing to talk about this, because remember, Moab and Ammon, they go back to these are the children of Lot by his daughters. And Moab, even the name itself, means from my father. That's what the name Moab means. And so the Moabites and the Ammonites have their origin in this incestuous relationship. And they're always they receive special opprobriation from the Hebrew people because of their origin. Now, the thing you have to remember in this particular context is that Moab, this area, is a very fertile country. It's something that is very fruitful. It's a nice plain, and it's very prosperous. And so, what Aelred uses for this is the excessive focusing on the needs of nature, on natural necessities, and he even keys in on this fact that it's from the Father, for all of us from our birth. There are things that we simply inherit as natural needs, that hunger and thirst and sleep and warmth and so on. But what we can do, of course, is focus on those in an excessive way, that we can put our natural needs above other things, that we become, as it were, self-indulgent. And again, it's sometimes I think modern technology sort of exacerbates this. When I was in the Philippines, I remember there were a number of places I was staying that they would have like the spigot for the tub, but they had no shower. So you basically got in kind of squatting position in the shower, and you had a little bucket called a tabo, and you poured it over your head. You know, that was how you took a shower. Think of the contrast for many of us. You know, you get in the shower and you sit there with that knob and you fiddle around with it till it's just right. Oh, no, 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 just a little too cold. No, 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 just a little too warm. No, no, one notch over. No, no, two notches back. You can get that water exactly the way you want it. Now, of course, it's a need of nature that you're clean. It's a need of nature that you have some kind of warmth. Those are all needs of nature. But what we can do is simply fixate on that in ways that really become excessive, in which we become really self-indulgent. So that the cure for that is that you are able to be, that you're able to mortify yourself. You know, there was a guy I knew in college that he would always, how did he do this again? At the end of his showers, he would turn them on cold and say three Hail Marys. Yeah, he would turn on cold and say three Hail Marys. And I said, what kind of got you started on that? And he said, I read this book on souls in purgatory. And one of the episodes in this book was this guy who had died, and then he like came back from the dead, and he led this really austere and self-sacrificial life. And people ask him, you know, why do you do this? And he said, because after I died, I had this vision of what life was like in purgatory and the sufferings of purgatory. And if you saw what I saw, you would do more. And this guy would just like, he'd be out in like the river in wintertime, just up to his neck in the river. And so he said, so this friend who told me this, he said, I'm not going out in the river in the middle of winter, but I can do more. And, you know, three Hail Marys under a cold shower, you know, that's, I can do that. So sometimes even little things, little penitential things, can help push back against our desire for comforts. This is the burden of Damascus. And by the way, numbers, of course, are the chapters. I don't know exactly where he gets this from, because I looked and I looked and I couldn't find it. But he interprets Damascus to be bloodshed. That the fundus sanguinis, like a form of blood or a bloody form, and interprets then Damascus to the burden of Damascus to be fighting our own anger, which is of course the source of all of our hatreds and bad deeds against others. If anger is the right word, you know, resentment. I've noticed culturally, and I tell my sophomores this. One of the cultural problems, I just think, in Minnesota is because the Minnesotan culture is founded by Northern Europeans, it tends to be great displays of emotion or whatnot. That's bad. That's crass. So you always have to look warmer, friendlier than you really feel. But the flip side of that is that Minnesotans, again, going back to Northern Europeans, you stew more. As opposed to just, look, I'm fed up with what you're doing, right? And letting it all out. You just stew, seethe. So you can have these resentments that literally go on for months or years. I think of a parent that talked to the principal and then eventually talked to me. She was angry with me about something I said in a parent-teacher conference. She was angry for 3 months. And I just think about when a parent that I had in Alaska, Alaskan culture is not like, she came in and just, I don't like what you said to my boy. And what do you think I said, right? And now you go back and forth and you work it out. It's done. So when you look at anger, don't think anger blowing up. You know, that could be a problem. That can be excessive. That can be uncomfortable. But anger can also be just like stewing and resenting. Because that just makes it harder to let go of your anger and harder to forgive. And that's quite one of my concerns about a non-confrontational culture. A non-confrontational culture tends to bury those emotions longer. And yeah, don't get me wrong, there are disadvantages to being all New York and New Jersey on people too. When we talk about healing from anger, that I think is an important thing to be aware of in our own circumstances, in our own situation. The burden of Egypt. And he talks about the darkness of ignorance. And as I was looking through the text, I think the thing that, where is this? This is in 19. I think it's 19:3. I think it's the discussion of oracles the Egyptian oracles. That leads Aelred in that direction. So, behold, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and comes to Egypt, and the idols of Egypt will tremble at his presence, and the heart of the Egyptians will melt within them. And I will stir up Egyptian against Egyptian. Every man will fight against his brother. But notice as he keeps talking, the spirit of the Egyptians within them will be emptied out. I will confound their plans. They will consult their idols and sorcerers, their mediums and wizards. Okay? So it's not so much there, idolatry or superstition. That's part of the picture. But here, Egypt means, as Aelred says, darkness. And the darkness of ignorance more than the darkness of iniquity. So as it were, think of people who, they make bad judgments. But they don't make bad judgments just from bad will. They make bad judgments because they really are, for lack of a better word, clueless about where to look and where to go. These people consult the wizards and sorcerers because they don't really know the true God and they don't know the source of the truth. There can be all sorts of people that you know that you think they're on the wrong path, you think they're on the wrong way, you're pretty sure they are. But it really isn't from bad will. Sometimes you run into this thing that in the Catholic world we call invincible ignorance. Invincible ignorance means you have some kind of ignorance that is not able to be overcome by ordinary effort. And usually the classic examples of invincible ignorance are young people. So when you read Huckleberry Finn, and Huckleberry Finn is helping Jim escape, he's 13 years old and he's grown up in a slave society. So he thinks that what he's doing is wrong. Huckleberry Finn is firmly convinced that he is stealing a slave and that he's treacherous to this woman, this elderly woman, who this is like her only servant. Okay? He doesn't know that he's doing something good. So if you were to sit there and try to explain it to Huckleberry, would he be able to get it? Probably not. You know, hopefully as he got older, you'd be able to free him from that kind of error. I mean, after all, that's what happened to Mark Twain. Mark Twain grew up in the rural South just like Huckleberry, but eventually grew away from the beliefs that he was formed as a kid. But we all know adults that suffer from, for lack of a better word, invincible ignorance. Ignorance that does not seem to be able to be overcome by ordinary effort. That at somewhere along the line, they blunder into something. Now, of course, what can be disturbing is the idea that there can be things in us like that. There can be forms of ignorance. And then it's a matter of when the truth comes along that we have the humility to be able to say, I was just wrong about that. And that can come from all sorts of sources. Sometimes it comes from our own children. Sometimes there are things that they pick up here and there that they've learned, they've gone deeper into something, and you just, you're right. That's acknowledge is the cure for ignorance. We don't always like it when that we would like to pick the way in which that enlightenment comes, but it comes sometimes without our hand in it. So that we are open to the truth. We're open to healing our own ignorance, because our own ignorance, again, it isn't necessarily bad will. It can be just sometimes just bad formation. Go ahead, sir. It could be, but insofar as you have sins insofar as there are things of which you are ignorant, that the ignorance in some way goes back to the way you were raised or the culture you're in, you could describe that as generational. There's some amount of ignorance that I think is just personal, where it actually mom and dad really did try and somehow you just didn't get it. You know, I think of things that my parents tried to get into me for years, and it didn't go in until I woke up to it somewhere in my mid-20s. Hey, that's why mom and dad kept saying that. So there's hope. If there's something that you keep repeating that you don't think it's ever going in, there are times that they somehow wake up to it. But before that, it was like you just couldn't hear it. And again, it isn't necessarily bad will. It can be that somehow you're being told something that doesn't seem to fit what you're seeing. Yeah. Mrs. Bettina, is your hand up? Or
I'm just raising it because.
Yeah, I know. That's what I suspected. But I don't want you to feel I'm discriminating against you because you're physically disadvantaged there. In chapter 21, this is where it talks about the burden of the desert of the sea. In our translation, the wilderness of the sea. And as Aelred explains it, there's kind of two things going on there. The power of Babylon was great enough, you know, in the way that they swept over the people around them, that they really are talked about like a kind of an ocean, like a kind of a tide rolling in, sweeping everything in their path. But at the same time, this is something that is bound to fall, that is bound to, and when it collapses, then, as it were, it dries up. So it's as if these two aspects, of Babylon are being conveyed by this idea of the desert of the sea. I haven't mentioned this yet, and I probably should. We know how Babylon fell to the Persians from Herodotus. Herodotus is the Greek historian who wrote about the Persian Wars. So he writes about this as kind of background to how the Persians got their empire going. What Cyrus did is he's encamped outside Babylon. And this is in the reign of Balthazar. Remember the many, many Thekel Upharsin, right? The writing on the wall. This is in the reign of Balthazar. And they think that they're invulnerable. There's no way that that the Persians are going to be able to take their city, because they've not only do they have their walls, but it's kind of surrounded by this river. Well, there's a night that the Persians are, that the Babylonians are celebrating, and you know, sort of like New Year's, and they are all just passed out drunk. And so, what the Persians do, starting just as it's dark, is they build up the system to reroute the river. And they push the river into a different channel. So this area that the Babylonians have been relying on dries out. And so instead of having something that you couldn't get into because the river was in the way, they're essentially going under the walls and then into the city. And once, of course, they get into the city, it's like you hear about with George Washington and the Hessians celebrating Christmas. You know, they're not very spirited to fight back. That was part of the crossing the Delaware. Remember, that was Christmas night. The Hessians had been partying the night before. They've been celebrating Christmas. Sneaky George Washington. So the Persians do something similar. So they take the city, which the Babylonians thought, right, that the city couldn't be taken. And again, it's one of these kind of great lessons of pride. They were so secure in themselves that they thought they could just sort of celebrate their invincibility. They were vincible, as it turns out. So in the desert of the sea, one of the things that's also, or that Aelred sees in this, is that the way in which the Babylonians are kind of like, a wave, an army, that you see in this the persecution of evildoers. That in other words, that in living a Christian life or living a faithful life, Christ warns you to live a faithful life means you will endure persecution. At the very least, you will endure misunderstanding and contradiction. And that, in a way, is like the burden of the desert of the sea. He puts it nicely that he talks about how it is that living in the world with the opinions of the world, it is always in motion. Sometimes it's wandering, sometimes it's stable, sometimes in a permanent state, sometimes swollen by pride, sometimes with a fever of wrath, now sad, now light, now silent, now dissolute laughter, right? In other words, the ways of the world are flux and change, and the idea of being faithful is that you have this stability. So think about, in fact, about that image that our Lord uses about having your house built on rock. That if it's built on sand, the winds come, the waves come, it washes away. So to be a Christian means that your house has to be built on rock. That it has to be stability. That you have to have, to use the expression, the courage of your convictions. Again, one of the things that I will tell sophomores, but then I will when I have them older, when I have seniors, if your self-understanding is I am Catholic or I am Christian because my mother and father have raised me this way or this is my upbringing, you're not going to stay Catholic or Christian very long. At a certain point, you got to say, I believe this because it's true. Like when you stand up and say the creed, I believe in God the Father Almighty. I believe in, right, Jesus Christ, His only Son, our Lord. I believe in the Holy Catholic Church. I believe it. At a certain point, you've got to have buy-in. You're not going to be able to go to college. My mother and my father raised me to be a good Catholic. No. At some point, you've got to believe it. Or not. maybe if you're honest with yourself and you don't believe it, now you'll give yourself a chance to actually believe it. Because, maybe you're without it and you come back. But there has to be the conviction that somehow this is yours. I heard a Byzantine Rite priest put it so nicely. God does not have grandchildren. God does not have grandchildren. They're not in God. They're not God's child because you're their child. You know, they're the child because in some way they have internalized what it is you gave them. The burden of Duma. We're still in chapter 21. In fact, there are a couple in 21. The desert of the sea, Duma, and then Arabia. And it's interesting. He talks about how the burden of Duma, hidden mental agitation. And I always, I think what he gravitates to is this line that comes right afterwards. One is calling to me from Seir. This is verse 11. Watchman, watchman, what of the night? Watchman, what of the night? The watchman says, morning comes and also the night. If you will inquire, inquire, come back again. And this is a line for me that I always associate with a book called Iota Unum. Iota Unum is a very long book. It's about 700 pages. But what its subtitle is, A Survey in the Changes in the Catholic Church. It was written by a peritus, that is a theological expert at the Second Vatican Council, or Romano Amerio. He was a professor of classics at a northern Italian university, and he was at the council. And what he does is he just takes these different areas of church life, priesthood, matrimony, war and peace, the natural law, that's why the book's as long as it is, and he surveys what were people thinking sort of before the council and what are the things that you hear after the council. And what he surveys is, and he uses all official sources. He's using things like L'Osservatore Romano, bishops. You know, he's not using mainline Catholic publications. And he just shows how many different areas there was almost a 180 from what it is that people were saying before the council and the way in which, and as a peritus at the council, he's not blaming the council, but he says there came a certain point where people left the council behind. That's the way he puts it. The council is left behind. And at the end of that book, it's a very sobering book because he's surveying all of these different aspects of church life that have just gone in a totally different direction from that first half of the 20th century and not in a direction that was sort of laid out or pointed out by those documents at the council. He ends the book with this text. He says, we may be in this period of waiting. Watchman, watchman, what of the night? Inquire, wait later. And he says, that's the position of many, many Catholics. Where is this all going to fall out? Where is this going to end up? Where is this going to land? Go ahead.
Can you repeat the title?
Sure, Iota Unum. So I-O-T-A, Iota Unum, U-N-U-M. And of course, what he's alluding to is this line from Matthew. Not one jot, not one tittle, not one iota shall the law change. And the perception of many people growing up, especially in the 70s and 80s, even during the beginning of certainly 60s and 70s, up to the pontificate of John Paul II, but even then there were things destabilizing. Anyway, the sense that everything's up for grabs. That you don't know what it is that you're really supposed to believe anymore. You know, the experience of many, many Catholics who will go to church and even from the pulpit they'll hear, we used to believe, but now we know. We used to believe. That became almost a little formula. And certainly, a lot of your kids and Catholic colleges hear that. We used to believe, now we know. Where is that all going? So that's Romano Amerio's concern. But he ends the book with this line. And in the context of Aelred, what he talks about more specifically, mental agitation. In other words, when you're the burden of uncertainty and the way that can make your spiritual life very, very difficult. If you have a sense of resignation, something bad is going to happen, I have to adjust to it. You can do something about that. But when you have the mental, is it going to be like this? Is it going to be like that? Is it going to be this way? Is it going to be that way? You'll notice that if you have seniors, you can have two kinds of seniors when it comes to that college application process. You know, these seniors, they put things together, they send them off, and they're done. And they say, you know, I'm going to hang out with my friends because I'm not going to see them as often. I'm going to really get into my sport because I'm not going to be playing sports at college. I can't quite play at that level. I'm going to enjoy this time I have. There are other seniors that they send off their stuff. What if I get in? What if I don't? What if I get into my first choice? What if I get to my reach? What if I don't? What if I get money? What if I don't? Right? They have no peace. They have no peace. And so part of maturation into adulthood is that you are able to kind of take those situations and be able to learn resignation or be able to learn at least some kind of patience. But there are all sorts of things, especially as a parent, where you worry for your children, you worry for the future, you worry about your finances, you worry about this, and you're agitated. And that agitation is not something that is helpful usually for your spiritual or moral life. So when Jesus talks about taking away anxiety, be not afraid, you know, do not live in fear, that can be what's generating that. The burden of Arabia, if you look down, where is that? That's also in 21. In the thickets of Arabia you will lodge, bring the thirsty water, meet the fugitive with bread. There he talks about the dread of our final destiny, the consideration of death. I'm still thinking through how exactly he relates that to what's in the text. But in any event, just a second here. Let me look at this thing. Oh, that's what it was. So if you look at verse 13, part of the difference here is the translation. The oracle concerning Arabia, in the thickets you will lodge, in caravans of Dedanites. In other translations, it will refer to evening. What is it? By evening you will sleep in the woods. And so that's not in this. When it says you will lodge, the implication is you're talking about evening. You know, you're coming at the end of the journey. You're coming at the end of the day. And he talks about how it is that evening is, you know, the border between day and night. And thus it implies kind of the evening of life, that boundary between this life and the next life. And when you speak of the burden of Arabia, that in some way that you're able to have peace about your own mortality, that you're able to have peace about your own end. Sometimes when there are people who die around us, we're sad because of the loss. But sometimes we're sad really for that we're thrown back upon ourselves. What used to be described as the great reminder. Sometimes they would put this on tombstones. As I am, as you are, I once was. As I am, you will be. Right? The great reminder. And that's a distressing thing for some of us. We want to veil that reality. One easy way to see this, years ago when I did my will, the lawyer gave me a little kind of kudos and said, most people don't want to make a will. There's only of the adult population, there's 30-40%. Going into that. And of course, I totally understood why that is, because as I'm doing this thing, you don't like sitting there having to think about, I'm gone. This is a discussion all about what happens after I'm gone. But I just, for no other reason, I wanted to make sure that, they don't play on eagle's wings at my funeral. That was, if there was one reason or anything else to work, to think about the arrangement, yeah, I don't. I told my wife, if you play on eagle's wings, I will come out of my casket. I will come out of my casket to stop you. In any event, so that we have a reasonable fear of our mortality, but that we're able to accept our death, and most importantly, as the way that Aylred puts it, most importantly for our conscience. Because if you are aware that you have an end, you have a finite amount of time, that means that you will have a better sense of coming before judgment, I have to live in a way that if I were to go out tomorrow, next week, next month, would I be ready to appear before my Lord? Would I have a conscience? Or am I doing, we used to use this expression more often, am I trifling with my conscience? Am I, as it were, thinking, I got plenty of time. I got plenty of time to, so sanctity is always something that happens in the future. Sanctity is always something that happens, oh, maybe next year I'll be saintly. Maybe 10 years from now I'll be saintly. Maybe I'll be getting saintly, like little tiny bits at a time. And like after 20 years you add it all up, I'll be saintly. Okay, as opposed to the language of St. Paul. Now is the day of salvation. Now is the day that you're supposed to be, as it were, grabbing it right then and not putting it off. So the understanding your own mortality, understanding your own death, is not just being morbid. Understanding your own mortality and your own death is meant to give you the perspective you need to understand the meaning and importance of your life and the meaning and importance of your own actions, that you only have so much time and that that is time you don't want to waste. Okay? I remember one of the things my father said before he got in his accident and he was in the hospital and whatnot. He was in the hospital for 5 days before he died. He was T-boned in a car accident. He talked about how, looking back, one of the things that he regrets is what he called wasted suffering. There was suffering that I could have offered up for souls, for all sorts of things, for myself. But instead, I just suffered and was bitter and complained. But he says, as you're really moving into what is the end of your life, he said, don't do that. Don't make that same mistake. Be able to look at your suffering and to be able to have your suffering be applied to others, for souls in purgatory, for the conversion of others, for other people's good. Never let suffering go unwasted, because there's so much that I've suffered in my life, but I didn't make use of it. I didn't let it become something transformative. That was one of my father's regrets. So I didn't get through all of this, and I hope to, but that's fine. We can, if you can stand the suspense, we'll finish this next time. And in the chapters to come, 27 and 28, I know it just seems like 2 weeks ago we were talking about the devil. We're going to be talking about the devil again, because at the beginning of 27, he's talking about the Leviathan. That's something that is a figure of the devil. You see that in the book of Job. So we'll talk a little bit about how the Leviathan occurs in the book of Job, and then we'll talk about it in the context of Isaiah. Very good. See you next week. Thank you.
Dr. Whitmer, how does it that the Protestant